Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is May 17th, 2023. We have three cases on our oral calendar this morning. The first of which is A23-0168 in the matter of the welfare of the child of JLG. So, counsel, you can go ahead and take the podium. Each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments, 5 minutes for rebuttal for the appellant, if you choose to use it. And then if each of you can please state the name of the party you represent and your own name at the start of your argument, that would be great. And we are ready for you whenever you're ready.
Great, thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Brooke Beskow-Warg, and I represent appellant mother JLG. In this appeal of the orders adjudicating her child is in need of protection or services and denying her motion for a new trial. Appellant asks this court to reverse those orders and remand to the district court for a new trial. The Minnesota Rules of Juvenile Protection Procedure and Chapter 260C outline the proper procedures in child in need of protection or services or CHIPS matters. The law covers the timeline for hearings, trials and decisions. It also details when a court may order a parent to comply with a case plan. Finally, the law provides that parents have certain rights as parties to the proceedings, including but not limited to presenting evidence and witnesses. The law is meant to protect due process rights for all individuals in the proceedings, including parents. This is one of the stated purposes of the Minnesota Rules of Juvenile Protection Procedure. The laws are created for a purpose, and when those are violated, we need to take a closer look at how those violations impact the proceedings and the outcome of the matter. That is what appellant is asking the court to do today. I want to focus my attention today on two of the issues presented. First, whether the district court could consider mother's noncompliance with the voluntary case plan, and second, whether the district court erroneously excluded mother's witness. As to the first issue, the district court violated mother's due process rights when it relied substantially on mother's noncompliance with her voluntary interim case plan in determining her child was in need of protection or services.
So can I, just to focus the issue actually for both of you, I have this question. A voluntary versus a mandatory case plan. What are the consequences of violation of a mandatory case plan in that setting? I'm trying to understand the difference. Like your argument, I think, is essentially it's making it mandatory by considering it at a CHIPS adjudication.
That is correct.
And I'm want to know from an accountant, like, what's the difference between mandatory and voluntary? In other words, what would be the consequences of violating a mandatory one, if not consideration at a later, you know, disposition? So I'm trying to understand the difference between those two. At the same time, I think the argument from an accountant is if at the trial time you have to consider whether a child is presently at risk, you just don't ignore everything that's happened between the emergency protective hearing and the date of trial, what do you do with that? I mean, why wouldn't one consider whether whatever conditions were present then have actually there's some progress or lack of progress?
Sure. So as to the first part of the question, lack of compliance with a mandatory case plan at later stage of the proceedings is absolutely relevant in terms of permanency outcomes. Some of the permanency dispositions, especially in a termination of parental rights, take into consideration whether the parent actually complied with the case plan. At the CHIPS adjudication stage, that is not the case. Up until the time and until after when the CHIPS adjudication actually occurs, that case plan is simply voluntary. Oftentimes courts, as is the case here, will submit or there will be some sort of voluntary interim case plan with things that a parent might start working on in the beginning stages of the case. But as Your Honor noted, in using that as a reason to adjudicate a child as in need of protection or services in the early stages of the proceedings essentially turns that voluntary case plan into a mandatory case plan, which is contrary to the law.
So what is your position? And it cannot be What happened, I mean, a case plan is provided in order to help the parent, to make reasonable efforts at reunifying the family, reuniting the parent after the parent child has been removed from the home. Is it your argument that none of that evidence can even come in as to whether any of those, the parent availed themselves of any of those services and succeeded or didn't on them?
So the court also does need to consider reasonable efforts of the agency. So certainly whether the county is creating or providing a case plan is relevant to that determination. So I wouldn't go so far as to say none of that evidence can come in, because it certainly is relevant to that reasonable efforts question. However, when it comes to the CHIPS adjudication and the actual statutory grounds, it is contrary to the law and to just notions of fundamental fairness to require a parent to comply with elements of a case plan that have not yet been ordered. That is essentially what the CHIPS trial is about. Is this child in need of protection or services? What should the disposition be? And how should we remedy those issues? After a CHIPS adjudication occurs is when the court actually then orders and approves that mandatory case plan that becomes relevant for later stages of the proceedings when we are talking about termination or a transfer of custody or whatever it may be.
Counsel, isn't the logical extension of your argument then that it's a disincentive to have a robust voluntary case plan before CHIPS adjudication? If you're saying, look, we can't look at the evidence of compliance or noncompliance with a case plan, then the incentives is, well, don't, have a very narrow one. You know, don't make, all the efforts you could, county. Could you help me with that? Because I'm struggling.
So the county is still required to make reasonable efforts regardless. That is their obligation. That is their duty. That is what is provided for under the law. And part of that is creating a case plan. Of course, by the time we get to the mandatory case plan stage, we've gone through a lot of different processes. We've done a joint development with the parent. We've had court oversight and approval of that. Generally, that interim or voluntary case plan at the beginning sometimes is as minimal in some counties as comply or listen to the department or the agency, cooperate with them, and maybe sign releases of information. In this county, of course, they tend to be a little bit more robust, but that is not the case everywhere. And so in some cases, it's important to look at what is in that case plan.
But if the key to kind of a CHIPS determination, right, is, is the child being abused or neglected or appears to be currently at risk.
Correct.
Isn't what the parent is doing with regards to a voluntary case plan, isn't that evidence about whether the child is or is not currently at risk? Sometimes favorably, sometimes not favorably.
So, Your Honor, what I would say on that point is we have a lack of guidance on that particular issue. What can the court all consider at the CHIPS adjudication stage when determining whether a child is in need of protection or services? Of course, we have the statutory language. We have some case law that's providing a little bit of guidance, like SSW and HGD, but we really don't have a particular answer to that very question.
So are you suggesting we should be issuing a precedential opinion in this case?
Your Honor, that may be. I don't know if that particular issue is squarely in front of the court. Certainly the issue of whether you can consider a case plan, the noncompliance with a voluntary case plan, is squarely before the court. Whether and what we can all consider at a CHIPS adjudication stage is sort of underlying here, but not necessarily squarely before the court. Certainly it would be helpful to have some guidance on that very issue, though.
I mean, I'm wondering whether the difference, though, between the two, and I appreciate trying to figure this out, is the difference between mandatory and voluntary. I mean, the mandatory ones result in statutory, there are statutory consequences that follow, right,
from
noncompliance. There are not statutory consequences that follow from noncompliance with a voluntary. Does that mean that whatever conduct occurred relative to the efforts provided is barred from consideration? Otherwise it becomes mandatory. I mean, they are differently addressed. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, they are differently addressed. Of course, as kind of discussed earlier, once we get to the permanency proceedings and TPR, it is certainly a relevant consideration. But the case plan compliance is not strictly or directly related to any of the CHIPS statutory grounds in the same way that it is in permanency proceedings. And so for that reason here, along with the fact that the statute and the rule do say that the case plan cannot be ordered until a CHIPS adjudication has happened, the court should not be able to consider whether the parent complied, especially in situations where we have non-compliance with that case plan.
I do want to make sure we get to your second issue, but I don't want to rush you through if
sure.
you have more, because I know we've been focused sort of on...
Sure, Your Honor.
Could I ask one question about the case plan, though? So are you saying that the district court can't look at what the parent did or did not do under the case plan, or are you simply saying the court can't say that's compliance or that's not compliance? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think I understand the question. And that, you know, kind of creates some issues, right? Again, what can we all look at when we're talking about a CHIPS adjudication? But certainly, we cannot use against a parent the fact that they have not complied with a voluntary case plan in determining a child is in need of protection or services. I guess that would be my argument summed up in a nutshell.
And so if a parent had complied with the voluntary case plan, should that not be considered when at the CHIPS determination? Isn't that the other side of what you're arguing?
That would be the other side. And certainly a parent's compliance, you know, I think of in that situation a case, which we see plenty of these cases where the issue that brings the case into court is that the parent has a home that is not suitable, right? Or they are maybe homeless, whatever it might be. And by the time they get into court, they've remedied that issue. And certainly the child is no longer in need of protection or services under that situation. But to use a parent's non-compliance as a reason to find the child is in need of protection or services is contrary to the law. I would also just note, kind of in closing on that argument, it really does create an impossible conundrum for parents at this stage of the proceedings. If they comply and complete an assessment, as happened in this case, then the agency has more evidence to use against the parent, even though they did not have to necessarily complete that assessment. However, if they don't comply, then the court has free rein to determine that the child is in need of protection or services based on their noncompliance. It really creates an impossible situation for a parent in determining what to do in that scenario. As for the second issue,
can I focus you on some questions? First of all, the standard of review for the second issue, the exclusion of the grandmother's testimony, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is it the case that you raise it as a due process issue?
That's correct.
Is it similar in child protection that due process is essentially subordinate to the rules of evidence, like in the criminal arena, such that, you know, the right to put on a defense is dictated, when it's an evidentiary matter, it's dictated by the rules of evidence, and then they're still evaluated under an abuse of discretion standard. Could you speak to that?
Your Honor, I don't know if there's case law in the child protection context directly on that point, at least not that I am aware of. Certainly, I did frame this as a due process issue. Generally, due process issues, even in the child protection context, are reviewed de novo, and so that is what I would argue the standard of review should be here, whether there was a due process violation.
So our de novo review is whether that testimony should have been admitted.
That is correct.
Without any deference to the district court.
Essentially, well, whether there was a due process violation in excluding mother's witness that she wished to call.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then when we get to what mother, the witness was going to testify to, I understand that it was being offered in order to corroborate mother's testimony about the events around, was it June 2nd? I forget the precise date.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really see an offer proof precisely about what that meant. In other words, when was she on the phone? What was she trying to corroborate? Was she there at the start of the altercation? I don't really see what was offered to corroborate, at what point during the day's events she was going to offer testimony.
Sure, and Your Honor is correct that in the offer of proof, that was not necessarily stated. However, Mother, when she was testifying, did state that she was speaking to her mother, so the grandmother of the child, on the phone when the altercation began.
What does that mean, when the altercation began, relative to what we know happened here? I think taking away electronics and then the mom tried to leave. Like, at what point, like when she went in to take the electronics, when did the witness get on the phone with the mom to witness what happened?
That answer I do not have based on the record. All I know is that Mother testified that she was on the phone when the incident began. I believe she said when the child began escalating. So whether it was the incident that, you know, brought on the violence or not, I cannot say based on the record.
Because I know you're out of time. I'm just going to ask, because for me it seems problematic, because there was not, I mean, there's, I think, even video, you can see video of what happened. There's no contesting that the child acted out physically against mom. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was not contested. So I'm not sure what the other witness, without a more specific offer of proof, was going to change about what, I mean, the district court said that it's not contested that the child acted out physically against mom. So unless we know, you know, mom says it was one-sided, I didn't start it, or whatever, unless we know what that witness was going to actually testify to from an offer of proof, it's hard to find a due process violation that it would be was prejudicial to exclude.
Sure. And, Your Honor, just on that note, if I may, otherwise I can address it on rebuttal. I would note that ultimately, you know, it was uncontested, yet the court still made a number of findings that Mother, you know, found herself to be the victim of this violence, that she was contributing to these altercations, essentially that she was part of the problem, if not the entire problem in this relationship, causing the issues. Had we had, and the court essentially did not believe Mother's testimony when she said that it was one-sided violence. And so even though it was uncontested, the corroboration could have helped or possibly changed the court's mind as to Mother's credibility on those issues. Instead, the court determined that Mother was essentially not credible, that she was not the victim of one-sided violence, and that she was an issue in this relationship, which supported the CHIPS adjudication.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Good morning to Your Honors and counsel, and may it please the court. My name is Britta Nicholson, and I am appearing on behalf of the respondent in this matter, who is the Hennepin County Human Services and Public Health Department. I would rely primarily on my written brief regarding the initial arguments that were made in appellant's initial brief, but I would like to use my time today to address some issues that were raised both on oral argument and also in the appellant's reply brief. I would start with some issues that were raised during oral argument. Your Honor asked about the distinction between when a case plan becomes court-ordered and mandatory and versus voluntary. I think Your Honor kind of hit the nail on the head when talking about how there are statutory consequences farther down the line for violation of a court-ordered case plan. For example, in Minnesota Statute 260C.301, Subdivision 1B5, which is a basis for termination of parental rights, for failing to correct the conditions that led to the out-of-home placement, there is a certain statutory presumption within it that requires a violation of a court-ordered case plan. And there is also case law out there, specifically the Simon case, that has some language for Subdivision 2 of the termination statute, the neglect of the parent-child duties, that a neglect can be presumed when a parent doesn't comply with a court-ordered case plan. So basically, a court-ordered case plan down the line can rise to some presumptions when it comes to termination of parental rights. In addition, I did want to point out that I think there's a useful analogy here, too, with the standards for termination of parental rights in voluntary case plans and CHIPS adjudications in voluntary case plans. So, for example, at the time of a termination of parental rights, the evidence has to demonstrate that a parent is presently unable to care for a child. Similarly, there is a similar standard at the time of a CHIPS adjudication, that the child is presently at risk and presently needs protection or services. And in the context of a termination of parental rights, there is a long line of case law that says a court-ordered case plan is not a prerequisite to a termination. It's not required for a termination. And in fact, the court can consider and can terminate based on lack of compliance with a voluntary case plan. I do have a number of citations, if Your Honors would like them, but there is a body of case law to that extent.
Why don't you give us one citation, if it's not in your brief?
It is not in my principal brief. Matter of the Welfare of the Child of ICG, that's 2017, Westlaw 487-2781, is just one example.
Thank you.
And that same logic applies to the context of a CHIPS adjudication, where if the court needs to make findings about the circumstances that exist at the time of the trial, they have to consider the parent's behavior during the case and whether or not their behavior corrected any concerns or demonstrates a present ability to safely care for a child. And if the court is permitted to consider a lack of compliance with a voluntary case plan when it comes to the ultimate issue of a termination of parental rights, which is a much more severe consequence than a CHIPS adjudication, the logic certainly follows that at the time of a CHIPS adjudication, when the standard remains similar about the conditions at the time, that the court can consider a lack of compliance with a voluntary case plan. I would also like to address the argument that was raised in oral argument and in the reply brief about how a voluntary case plan presents an impossible conundrum for parents prior to a CHIPS adjudication. The examples that appellant uses are that they basically view it as two choices. Either they comply and do assessments that reveal harmful information for the parent, or they don't comply and then the lack of compliance is used against them. However, that ignores an entire universe of possibilities where compliance with a voluntary case plan could be extremely beneficial to a parent. For example, they could complete an assessment. That assessment makes no diagnoses, recommends no services, and then the parent would certainly be trying to introduce that evidence at trial to prove that the child is not currently in need of protection or services. Or, for example, a parent could comply with a list of services in a voluntary case plan, remedy the issues, and then at a CHIPS trial, use that evidence to argue, I completed my case plan, there are no longer any current issues, so therefore my child is not currently in need of protection or services. So I don't think appellant can have it both ways here, where they're trying to argue that they would exclude any evidence of their lack of compliance, while on the flip side, I'm sure they would argue that a parent should be allowed to admit evidence of positive progress and compliance.
I don't know if it's really both ways, though, if it's voluntary. I think the argument is if you voluntarily comply with it and get good results, it's not inconsistent with the notion of voluntary for a parent to use their compliance with it positively, but that it is in conflict with the notion of voluntary to use noncompliance negatively.
Well, I think largely in appellant's brief, her argument is that the focus should solely be on the instance that brought the CHIPS case in the first place. However, if they would be trying to introduce argument of positive progress and change at a trial, that undermines their argument that the sole focus should be what opened the case in the first place. And, oh, sorry, Your Honor, do you have a question?
I was actually thinking about this, counsel. I'm glad you brought it up. And that, because isn't the time that went by before the trial in this matter, doesn't that exacerbate the challenge of, you know, relying upon a voluntary case plan? I mean, because if it's easier to focus on the incident that brought this into the system, right? If you're, you know, you're in trial in 60 days, as opposed to what, a trial began for an hour, 110 days later? I mean, I know that counsel didn't make that argument, but I see them as some, but that tie troubles me, if you could address that.
Yeah, when there is a delay in a child protection trial, it does certainly make it harder for the party with the burden of proof because a lot of the evidence will focus on the incident that brought the case in. And if that incident was 6 months ago, then that creates a challenge when proving that the child is currently in need of protection or services. And that is why the department should be allowed to present evidence of what has happened over the first 6 months. So I do believe it's a two-part analysis, which the district court did do in this case. Step one is what brought this case in the first place. what was the incident or what were the issues that necessitated child protection involvement, and in this case, necessitated the child's removal from the home. And in this case, the court made factual findings about that, about the June 1st incident, the hospitalization, the lack of shelter, refusing to take the child back into her home. There were ample factual findings about that. But then step two is, those issues existed and opened the case. Are they still issues? Is the child still in need of protection or services? And in order to make that leap and make that analysis, the court's most logical resource is examining what has happened in between that initial incident and the date of this trial. Has the parent remedied those issues to obviate the need for protection and services, or has the parent either done nothing or engaged in behavior that was harmful that really provides evidence that the child still remains in need of protection or services? And that actually leads into another argument I wanted to make about the consideration of compliance or lack thereof with a voluntary case plan. Appellant seems to conflate reliance with consideration. In this case, the district court considered appellant's lack of compliance with the voluntary case plan, but that wasn't the sole basis for finding that the child is currently in need of protection or services. There was ample evidence that I pointed out in my brief that apart from her noncompliance, appellant was actively engaging in behaviors that were harmful to the child during the pendency of the child protection case, which only serves to reinforce and bring up new concerns for the court about her present ability to provide care for that child. There was her decision to remove the child from her insurance, her decision to reschedule appointments for the child without consulting with the father, her refusal to give the child comfort items from her home that seemed almost vindictive and like punishment for the child, her ongoing insistence that the child needed residential services and appellant wanted nothing to do with the child until she received those services. That just kind of ostracization and blaming of the child for the child's mental health issues, all of those just provided additional evidence that if that child, if there was the case was dismissed and that child was returned to the mother, she would not be in a safe, stable, and supportive environment.
Are you suggesting that we could rely upon the, we could have find that the CHIPS finding was not erroneous here or was supported by the adequate evidence, clear and convincing evidence, just without the case plan? We'd say, look at the 2 weeks not providing shelter, look at the declining visitation.
Correct, because appellant seems to frame her argument as the court did just a one-step analysis of appellant didn't comply with her case plan, thus it's a CHIPS adjudication. However, that drastically oversimplifies the district court's order, where they walked through an entire process of this was the issue that brought the case in, this is why child protection involvement was necessitated in the first place, and here is a litany of concerns that have occurred between the EPC hearing and the trial that demonstrates that these issues are still at play and the appellant cannot currently safely resume care for the child. And yes, I agree that the consideration of the voluntary case plan was a part of that analysis, but the district court's findings were very clear about why they were addressing the voluntary case plan. Pretty much every time the court mentioned the lack of compliance with the voluntary case plan, the next sentence was, which is evidence that the issues have not been corrected. It wasn't a punitive measure. The district court wasn't inventing a statute that says, if you don't comply, you will get a CHIPS adjudication against you. The district court was not misapplying the law. What the district court was doing was saying that the lack of compliance with a voluntary case plan provides evidence of whether or not the child currently remains in need of protection or services. I would like to use some of my remaining time to address the other argument that was raised on oral argument about the district court's decision to not allow the grandmother to testify. So appellant is framing this as a due process violation because it interfered with her right to present evidence about the June 1st altercation at trial. However, the trial record is very clear that the appellant was given ample opportunity to present evidence about the June 1st incident. Appellant herself testified about it twice on two separate days of trial. She introduced a video of the altercation. She introduced photographs of her injuries following the altercation. There were multiple assessments that were received into evidence, including the parenting assessment and two assessments about the child that were completed before the case opened. And in those assessments, she again speaks about the June 1st incident or just speaks about the child's aggressive behaviors in general. And as Your Honor pointed out earlier, no party was contesting that the child got physical with her mother during that June 1st incident.
Right. I think that the argument, though, as you know, is that, you know, in, when you look at the court's first order, that, you know, mother said it was not her fault, referring, I think, specifically to that incident. It was one-sided. It was not her fault. She did nothing wrong. And then later in that, you know, go to the next page, it says, you know, that the district court said they find mother's testimony self-serving, et cetera. So the idea is that testimony, and that's why I sort of focus on precisely what it would be, was That the implication is that the court found her testimony about that incident not credible and that this would have helped. So can you speak to that?
Yes. So the court's credibility findings about appellant were based on a variety of factors, not just solely the June 1st incident alone. I believe it's on the second or third page. There's a whole section of credibility findings about appellant in the CHIPS adjudication order, and it talks about her testimony being inconsistent with the record. For example, I believe she testified about family therapy and why it didn't happen, or about parenting education and why it didn't happen, and that was contradicted by the record. There was also, again, it was self-serving. There was findings in the CHIPS adjudication order about how, you know, she has a vested interest in the outcome of the case. She's not an independent third party, things of that nature. So the credibility findings were wide-ranging and went well beyond just the June 1st incident.
So it doesn't matter in the end relative to credibility who, quote, started that particular.
Correct. And I think when the court was discussing the June 1st incident and was pointing out appellant's lack of insight, the court wasn't arguing that appellant was the initial physical aggressor, which is essentially what appellant was trying to argue with her mother's testimony. The district court was just concerned overall about appellant's lack of insight into the history of conflict with her child and how she doesn't think her emotional responses or her verbal responses to the child had any impact on how the child behaved. That was the district court's overriding concern, not just about that June 1st incident, who started the physical fight. And ultimately, at the end of the day, when seeking to reverse based on this narrow issue of the grandmother's testimony, appellant has the burden to prove that the outcome would have been substantially different if this grandmother had been allowed to testify. As Your Honor noted, there was not an ample offer of proof, but from the offer of proof we do have, it was that she didn't even directly see or witness the incident. She was on the phone and heard some commotion for a brief portion of the incident. Also, appellant's counsel during the trial even said that the testimony would only take about 5 minutes. So it doesn't sound like she really would have had much to add beyond what was already in the record. So the idea that this woman's testimony would have drastically changed the court's perception of the June 1st incident, which then in turn would have drastically changed her credibility assessment, which in turn would have drastically affected whether or not there was a CHIPS adjudication, that's simply too many links to make to argue that exclusion of this minimally relevant and cumulative testimony was an abuse of discretion. And it was well within the court's discretion under Minnesota Rule of Evidence 403, where they have wide discretion to exclude minimally relative evidence when considering whether it's cumulative or a waste of time. I see my time is up, so.
Can I ask one question? And I'm just looking at your brief for the answer, but you can just tell me. What do you tell us the standard of review is on this issue?
I believe it's an abuse of discretion because it was an evidentiary consideration under Minnesota Rule of Evidence 403.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. And rebuttal.
Your Honor, I would like to just address a few issues from respondent's argument. The first, with the issue of compliance with the case plan, counsel did cite to the ICG case. I would note that is a non-precedential case. I am not aware of any precedential case law that squarely addresses the issue of whether a court may use a parent's non-compliance with a voluntary case plan in either the CHIPS adjudication or in the finding for a TPR. So again, that is an unanswered question. I would also, to address a question that was asked, I apologize, I forgot who asked it, but, you know, so Your Honor mentioned, well, what happens if we just don't consider the lack of noncompliance? Is there enough evidence here to support a CHIPS adjudication? Essentially, then, what the order comes down to is that mother failed to provide shelter, which is no longer an issue. That issue is stale. It comes down to the argument over insurance and removing the child from insurance, which the court gave limited weight to, and then also changing some medical appointments. You know, mother's reasoning for that was that the child was not seeing her primary care physician, which was problematic, and then also a few instances of mother not providing items to the child.
And the original problem of physical altercations between mother and child and mother's ability to manage that to avoid such a thing.
Certainly, yes. The physical altercations are certainly part of that analysis. One thing that I would note about that is the court essentially focuses on what it believes are mother's shortcomings with that, mother's failures or mother's contributions to the history of conflict. The history of conflict is certainly there. It's in the testimony. Whether mother is the contributing factor in that, there isn't enough evidence to prove that. There certainly is not clear and convincing evidence in the record to prove that that is the case. So in terms of sufficiency of the evidence on the statutory grounds, I would argue that there is not enough evidence there to sustain that. I would also note on the final issue, in terms of the due process violation for excluding mother's witness, I would note that counsel focuses primarily on the lack of prejudice in that analysis. One thing I would note is that while cases do rely on that standard, so the requirement of prejudice, that issue is actually up at the Supreme Court right now, and they are seeking to clarify whether harmless error or the prejudice analysis should be considered in due process violations. So we are waiting for an answer on that particular question.
In which case are you talking about?
That would be, it's A22... 1066 and 65. It may be A23. I believe it's A22, though 1066 and 1065. It was a consolidated matter. So that is an issue that is going to be before the Supreme Court. Otherwise, Your Honors, I would just close with the fact that these violations, especially when viewed cumulatively, are troubling. Faith in our justice system certainly depends on the accused being able to present their case and a meaningful defense. It also depends on courts adhering to the law and making findings consistent with the law. That did not happen here in multiple ways. For these reasons and for others, as stated in my brief, I'd ask this court to reverse the CHIPS order and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you both. The case is submitted. I wanted to say thank you to both of you for really excellent briefs and oral arguments. Very helpful to the court. Very well done. Thank you.